Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to give this lecture. So I will mainly talk about derived symplectic geometry and use somehow this classical transformation theory as a kind of motivation. I won't say that much on transformation theory, though. But let's start with this. So what is it about? So let's pick M, some oriented three manifold, compact. And so the space of fields will be G bundles equipped with a connection. And well, what usually people write is this action functional. So let's assume that G is some compactly group inside GLN. Simple. And the action functional is, it takes, so let me just write it on the connection one form, just to make it simple. It just takes the integral over the manifold M of the volume thing, trace of dA wedge A plus 2/3 of A wedge A wedge A, the connection one form. And usually, I mean, people write some factor in front of this. I mean, we will deal with classical transformation theory, so the factor in front of it just doesn't matter. So and the space we will be interested in is the space of classical trajectories. And it's basically the critical locus of this action functional. So let me write crit of S. And in this case, it's fairly easy to check that it's actually the zero locus of the curvature map, which sends a connection to its curvature, which sends basically A to dA plus, well, A which A, right? So that's basically, once you've modeled out by the symmetries, that's the space of flat connection on M. Or rather, well, the space of flat G bundles, I mean. Okay, so let's look at what happened if M got some boundary. So let sigma be a surface but that bounds M. And we want to look at what happened at the boundary. So one description of this is as follows. So we take the space of all connections on sigma, and we have this map F. And it goes into two forms on sigma with values in G. And somehow, well, and here I'll be a little bit sloppy. You can identify this with the dual of functions on sigma with values in G, just by using the volume form that you had on sigma. And somehow you understand this map F as a moment map for a huge Lie algebra, which are functions with values in G. And so to speak about moment maps, you need some symplectic structure on that guy. If you fix the bundle, let's say we deal with a trivial bundle, that guy is roughly, it's an affine space, infinite dimensional, which is modeled it's modeled on just the space of one forms with values in G. And on this, you have a natural symplectic pairing, or, well, you have a pairing. So the pairing is just basically you pick two one forms with values in G, trace them, so take trace of the product. It gives a two form on sigma with values in G, and then you integrate over M, over sigma. So with values in R, sorry, and integrate over sigma. So it doesn't make sense so much of talking about symplectic structure, but this pairing is somehow weakly non-degenerate. So the adjoint of the pairing is an injective map. And assume you can do some infinite dimensional symplectic reduction. And well, you get basically flat connection modulo gauge equivalences. So you really get back the moduli space of flat connections, well, flat G connections on sigma. So and this has a symplectic structure. Well, so there's a lot of imprecise things, and you have to deal with infinite dimensional things, and that's not very satisfying. So another approach, would be to directly look at this moduli space. I mean, you can write a moduli problem and look at the smooth points of that guy, and look at the tangent space at a given connection to the moduli space of flat G connection on sigma. And again, I mean, this tangent space is just H1 of sigma with values in G. And on this, you get a pairing. It's constructed the same way as before. So you have H1 of sigma G tensor twice. Again, you use the trace map and cup product. You get H2 of sigma with values in R. And that's actually isomorphic to R, thanks to the volume form. And here, you get an actual pairing on a finite dimensional guy. So you get some two form. And you have to prove that it's closed. And people know how, I mean, people can do this. But it's not that, I mean, the proof is not that easy and that natural somehow. So one can prove that the two form is closed. But it requires some work, and it's, yeah, I would like to emphasize another way of just understanding this a bit later. And moreover, one can even better prove is that, so we have flat connections on the ambient manifold, and we can restrict them to flat connections on sigma. And under a lot of assumption, like, oh, let's restrict to the smooth locus of this moduli space. And here, let's take, well, some locus on the moduli space of flat connections. So basically, we take the subspace of flat connection on sigma, which extend to the whole of M, and we restrict to some locus where everything is nice and we really have a submanifold. Then in this case, this is a Lagrangian submanifold. But again, there's a lot of assumption that you have to make. You have to stay in the locus in which everything is fine. Okay. And there's yet another description of the moduli, of the symplectic structure on this moduli space of flat connection. It came out of the, I mean, it's due to Alexeyev, Malkin, and Mehrenkin. And basically, they wanted to have a perfectly fine finite dimensional model for this moduli space. And they wanted to have a construction where, I mean, the non-degeneracy and the closeness of the form makes perfect sense and arise in a very natural way. So here is how it works. So first of all, you identify flat connections on the surface with G-local systems, just by associating the holonomy of the connection to the flat connection. And that's nothing but the representation variety of the fundamental group of sigma in G, modded out by G conjugation. OK? So if you recall that, well, the pi 1 of sigma is just generated by ai's, bi's, which are just classes of A cycles and B cycles. by the relation that product of their commutator is just trivial. Then you see that this guy looks very much like some kind of symplectic reduction. So if you look at, just look at where the generators are sent, you get some g to the power 2g, and you get a map to g, mu, which is basically given it sends this 2g matrices to this product here. Then the local systems on sigma, that's just mu inverse of 1 mod out by g. And what Alexeyev, Malkin, and Mannerheim prove is that, well, this g to the power 2g, it's actually what is called a quasi-Hamiltonian g-space. So it's not quite symplectic, but all the feature of symplectic reduction and all what you do usually with symplectic reduction works perfectly well. And this space here now, this one is symplectic. So that's how they kind of produce the symplectic structure on the modi space of local system. And there's the whole story of how to relate this to the infinite dimensional picture. Let me just sketch how it works. So basically, you consider the map which goes from one forms on the circle with values in G to G. So we look at these as connection one forms, and we take the holonomy. This map is equivalent with respect to the loop group action on this side, and just conjugation action on that side, and the map from the loop group is just evaluating at one, let's say. So yeah, it's just gamma goes to gamma one. And what they do is the following. So they look at flat connections on sigma minus a disk. So that's actually a space that has a restriction to omega one s one of g. That's the restriction to the boundary. And you would like to look at this guy as a kind of, well, again, to do symplectic reduction in the infinite dimensional way, to say that somehow you have a flat connection on sigma minus the boundary. Then you evaluate it on the boundary, and you want the connection to be trivial because you want to fill the disk in your surface. So you're going to say, you're going to take the fiber of zero in here, and that will do, symplectic reduction. But that's still the infinite dimensional picture. And there's actually a way to relate these two pictures, which essentially boils down. It's not the way it's said in the Alexeyev, Malkin, Mannerheim paper, but that this map, so one forms with values in G, modded out by LG, the map which goes from G to from this to G mod G, this is actually an equivalence. It's definitely not the way they phrase it, but I would like to give you a context in which this saying that this is an equivalence makes perfect sense. Okay? So somehow, whenever you have a Hamiltonian LG space, there's a way to make it into a quasi-Hamiltonian G space. And that's how you go back and forth between the infinite dimensional version of the story and this finite model, which is quite not Hamiltonian, which is only quasi-Hamiltonian. OK, so the questions or goals, so the questions I would like to address in this talk are just the following. First of all, I would like to give some I would just like to give a context in which we don't need to care about those things. Also, I would like to say, well, when, for instance, M is such that I mean, it's closed. It has no boundary. What does it mean for this map here to be Lagrange? What does it mean to be Lagrangian in something which is just reduced to a point? It's a question I really would like to address. So what does it mean for the modular space of flat connection on M to be Lagrangian? A question which is very similar to that one is, how do I reconstruct somehow the action functional just from the moduli space of flat connection itself? So I have the reduced phase space, and without to get some structure on this, to remember that it actually comes from an action functional. So how to kind of recover S just from this guy here. So the first thing is just get rid of of all these things. So infinite dimensional technicalities, smoothness issues, and questions like this. That usually, it takes a lot of work to deal with, and I would like to avoid dealing with those. Okay. Right, so let me now try to give some intuition of what this derived implied geometry is about. And first, I have to talk about derived stacks, and I'm not going to define them, but try to give some idea. I will work in the differentiable context, even though, all the theory has been developed in algebraic geometry contexts. But it doesn't matter. You can work in the differential geometry context as well. It's fine. So if I have a smooth manifold, I really want to look at it as, I want to deal with differential geometry in the way I want to do algebraic geometry in the realm of differential geometry. So I really want to look at this as a functor from the category of manifolds to sets, and it's basically the functor of its points. It's nothing very complicated. It's just another manifold U to the smooth functions on U in X, right? And first of all, there's a first remark you can make here. Is that there are many functors which do not come from manifolds. For instance, if you take X a topological space, you can write a functor X tilde which sends U to continuous functions on U with values in X, right? And that's a perfectly well-defined somehow space on this. There are things I want to add as well. So for instance, I want to include smooth manifold which might have nilpotent points. So for instance, I really want to do things like algebraic geometry. So you want to include somehow what you would like to call spec Rx over X square. And that's what's this guy. It's somehow, and I'm going to say something which is wrong, it somehow send U to, and let's put quotes in here, F in C infinity of U such that F square is 1. That doesn't mean anything. That's just nothing. What you have to do is for this is to replace the category of manifold by what is called sin infinity rings. So basically, you want to consider all kind of rings which are equipped with operation which come from functions from Rn to R. If you would do it with polynomial function, you would get exactly rings, but it's a bit more structured than an actual ring. Okay, I don't know who to attribute this to. I mean, is it Dubuc who introduced infinity rings?
Lovere.
Okay. So that's the first thing we want to do, just to have access to infinitesimal. And then there's this. There are two more things we want to do. So even though we deal with those nice guys, the category of, let's say, a locally representable object is not going to be stable by pullbacks. So basically, you're going to do intersection. You'll get something a bit nasty. So to have a nice intersection, we have to replace this category by either the category of simplicial rings or differential graded in non-positive degree as infinity rings. And I don't want, so that I think the in this context, the first one who did that's David Spivak, I guess. But another way to do this is in one of Jacob Lurie's DAG. Sorry? DAG 5. Okay, thanks. So the idea is that whenever you have badly behaved intersection, what usually people do in differential geometry, they would do some small geometric perturbation to get things in transverse position. Here, you just do some kind of homological perturbation instead of doing actual geometric perturbation. And then you get a nice theory of intersection. And the last thing you want to do is to replace the category of sets by something much fancier. So we're going to take quotient by groups. So basically, we want to allow this quotient to exist. So we want to replace this perhaps by group weights, but then we might want to make further quotients. So let's just be a bit brutal and directly replace it by infinity group weights. Or topological space, that's just a model for infinity group weight, or simplicial sets, whatever you prefer. And here's, let me give you an example of such of an object. So let's take X, a topological space, and there's a functor, which I would call X Betty, which sends. So I will still view my U as a space. So you should view this U as the spectrum of some DGC infinity ring. But anyway, I'm going to do something very brutal. I'm going to remove all of the nilpotent points of this. So think of U red as just an actual manifold. And I'm going to look at the space of locally constant function on U red, right? So it's just a space because X is a space, right? So if you wish, it's a locally constant.
Into X.
Sorry?
Into X.
Oh yes, on red into X. Sure. Thank you.
That doesn't care about topology on X.
It does. It's a space of such function. So for instance, whenever, locally it's just X itself. Let's take U to be just Rn. That's just going to be X, but viewed as a space. So as an infinity groupoid, so it has just, it's the object of this groupoid will be just points of X. Morphisms in this groupoid will be passed between points, and two morphisms will be homotopies between these. So it really depends on the topology of X, sure. Okay? Right, so what you would want to call derived stacks are just such functors from derived infinity rings to spaces that satisfy reasonable local to global properties. I don't. So to really make sense of this, I would have to tell you what kind of topology I put on these derived C infinity rings, and I just don't want to discuss this. Just think of just if we were sticking to the original category manifold, that's the one you have in mind. I mean, that's it's generated by open embeddings. Okay. So what I really want to do is to actually do symplectic geometry with these objects. So and talk about these shifted symplectic structures, which were introduced in a great paper of Pantaev, Todenbecki, and Vizzozzi. Here's how it works. So to any x derived stack, so it's a functor like this, one can associate some gadget, which we would call the Durham algebra of x. And if x is an honest manifold, that's exactly its Durham algebra, right? And the way you define it is you define it locally, and you prove that these Durham functors satisfy some decent property. So it extends globally. And it can be defined for any stack. So it has a few features. So first of all, this guy has two different gradings. So we have the internal or cohomological degree, and what I will be calling the weight, which is just the degree of forms. For a usual manifold, these two degrees happen to coincide, but for stacks or derived stacks, they do not. And on this, we have two differential, the internal differential and the Durham differential. So the internal differential only raises the cohomological degree by one and does not is homogeneous for the weight. So it has just degree 1, 0. And the Durham differential has degree 1, 1. It raises both. And let me write just d dot for the sum of these two. I will need this later. And instead of giving a definition, let me give you an example. So assume that x is the stack quotient of an honest manifold by, let's say, a compact simple Lie group so here the Durham algebra of X is going to be the following thing, which if you have seen the definition of equivalent cohomology, you will just immediately recognize what we have here. So you'll get forms on M, tensor symmetric powers of G dual. And let me write a shift by -2 here. It just means that element of G dual have internal degree 2, right? And forms here have internal degree 1. And let's take G invariant. OK. And the two differentials are just, well, the Durham differential is the Durham differential on X tensor identity on the symmetric component part. So it raises the degree by 1, and it raises also the degree of forms by 1. So it's 1, 1. And the internal differential is just sum over I of contraction with a fundamental vector field times multiplication by xi I, where xi is just some basis of G, and xi I is the dual basis. And xi I vects is just the fundamental vector field associated to the element of the Lie algebra, which comes from the infinitesimal action. OK? Right, so that's something that, I mean, usually people have seen already. So it's this Durham algebra is not that mysterious. And so let me now give you the definition of a, so first, a two-form of degree, let's say k, by definition, that's a weight 2, d int cocycle of degree. So when I say degree, I will always mean the internal degree, 2 plus k inside dx. And a closed two-form of degree k, that's a weight. It's no longer of pure weight. It's actually of greater or equal to 2. And it's a cocycle for the total differential in the same guy. OK? So what's the difference between these two? A closed two-form will look like the following. So you'll get omega 0, which has pure weight 2, then omega 1, which will have weight 3. And so on. So it's a series, a closed two form. And you see, if you look at the equation, you'll get d int of omega 0 being 0. D deram of omega 0 will be actually up to sine d int of omega 1. And you'll get a bunch of identities like this. And as you see, there's an underlying two form, which is omega 0. So still, as usual, any closed two-form gives rise to a two-form. But it's not true that being a closed is a property. It's just a lot of additional structure, much more data. OK, let me give examples of these.
Choice of omega 0
admit
such data?
No. So a priori, a lift of a two-form to a closed two-form does not need to exist. And if it exists, that doesn't need to be unique. And it's even not unique in some homotopy sense. I mean, the space of all choices will not be contractible in general. So yeah. So let's go back to the case when x is m mod g. And let's look at a few examples of this. So first of all, if m is a point, and let's choose the basis xi to be orthonormal for the Cartan-Killing form, then you can define the following two form, sum over I, psi I square. So that's an element in sim 2 G dual minus 2 G invariant. And I have to shift back by 4 here. It means it's an element of degree 4 in this complex. And this 4, let me split it in 2 plus 2. So if you care about, if you're a bit careful about the numerology here, that gives you a two-form of degree 2. It's actually, you can check that it's closed. So there are no higher correction. Well, it's closed because here the Durand differential is just equal to 0 in this case. Another example is if M is the dual of the Lie algebra, then the form you get, you can form the form like this, sum over I d deram of xi. So xi is an element of g, so you view it as a function on g dual, times psi I. Well, that's a two form. It has two generators. And now you have only psi I, which has positive degree. So it's actually, if you check carefully, it's a closed two form of degree 1. If g is just trivial, then, for instance, close two form of degree zero are just exactly the usual two forms, close two forms on M. Let me, so. So, all these definitions just make sense. I mean, when you deal with actual manifold, you recover what you're used to. And the last example I want to give is when M is G itself, acted on by conjugation. Here, there's the following thing you can do. So there's, you have the right and the left Mollard-Carton form, and probably I will just write them wrong. I never know which one is which. Anyway, so there are these two elements associated to your Lie group. So let's take omega zero to be half of their sum. So a priori, that's a one form on G with values in G, and it's actually G invariant. But using the Carton-Killing form, you can just identify this with omega 1 G tensor G dual. So that defines actually, and you can check that it's closed by the internal differential. So it defines for you a two form of degree 1. But a priori, it's not closed. And if you compute the Durham of this, it's not 0. But it's D int of something. And this something is omega 1 is, 1 over 12. And you just have this standard element which define a three form on G. These are standard calculation in equivalent cohomology again. I mean, and what you can show is that omega 0 plus omega 1 defines a closed two form of degree 1 on this quotient stack G mod G by the adjunct action. OK. Good. So we have plenty of examples of closed forms of different degrees. And we will say that a closed two form of degree n on x is non-degenerate, and then in which case I will say n symplectic a closed two form omega if the underlying two form, so the being non-degenerate is a property of the underlying two form. You can check that the underlying two form gives you a map from the tangent complex to the cotangent complex. I mean, these are just the right object to consider, which are analog to tangent and cotangent bundle of your favorite manifolds. But now this is a map of complexes, and you don't require that it's an isomorphism, but just that it's a quasi-isomorphism. And the shift here just follows from it comes from the fact that the form has some cohomological degree. Okay, and let me say that in all examples I gave here, these are non-degenerate. So we have plenty of examples of shifted symplectic derived stacks. Well, so none of them are derived here, so these are actual stacks. Okay. Right, and there is this great theorem which is in the PTVV paper, which tells you that once you know a few examples of shifted symplectic stack, you got way a lot more by transgression. So let's say that X is either, so it's X will be an oriented compact D-manifold, Y some n-shifted symplectic derived stack, and then uh, the mapping stack, so the stack of maps from X Betty to Y, first of all, it happens to be a perfectly finite dimensional stack, if you wish. It's finitely generated, its tangent has finite dimensionally bounded cohomology. So even though it looks like a great, a big object, it's not actually. So this one is actually n minus d shifted symplectic. And let me say that actually this one happens to be, and that's a specific feature if you work in the differentiable setting, as the stacks from the map from the Durham stack of X to Y, but even though I don't want to define the Durham stack here. But let me just say that in the case when Y is point mod G, so it's BG, these two mapping stacks are just some derived enhancements of G local systems on X. And for the Durham one, that's a derived enhancement of flat G connections on X. Okay. Sorry?
Well, PDBB do it for kind of classical derived algebraic geometry, as it were.
So, yeah?
You're doing it with CMPINTY things.
Yes.
Do you need more proof?
Oh, well, I mean, once you've set up the context of, well, I mean, CINFINITY, I mean, differentiable derived stacks, I mean, everything works just the exact same. There's no, I mean, the only thing I would be more careful with if I would do just holomorphic version, which is much more difficult for derived geometry. Mauro knows about this, but I don't. But for this CINFINITY case, I mean, everything works just pretty much the same. Okay. Right, so let me give you some consequence of this. So I'll just stick with Y being BG all the time. So let's look at the case of S1. S1 is just BZ, so you just have to specify a point and an automorphism. So, well, that just happened to be G mod G. So BG is two shifted symplectic. S1 is one dimensional. So we recover, and actually that's that has been proven by Pavel Safronov, that the minus one shifted symplectic structure you get here is the one as the one is the same as the one I was describing before. So this is really, I mean, this equivalence is as one shifted symplectic guys. Right. Well, you could do the same with the Durham stack. So yeah, maybe there's also a map from S1 Durham to BG, which is equivalent to that one. And this one, if you look at the presentation of S1 Durham, so I really want to point out that S1 Durham and S1 Betty are just not equivalent. But it just happens that mapping out of them gives you equivalent things. In this case, that's just really this guy here that we had before. And in this case, and that's an important feature of derived geometry, this guy is still a perfectly finite dimensional object, even though it's presented using infinite dimensional guys. But if you compute its cotangent complex, it will be a two-term complex. Each term of the complex will be itself unbounded and a crazy vector space, let's say, if you do it at a point. But both the kernel and the co-kernel of the map are going to be just finite dimensional objects. So the cotangent complex of this guy is a perfect complex. Yeah, and in, anyway, it's equivalent to something finite, so it has to be finite enough. Okay, so that's the first example I wanted to give. The second one is you take sigma, a surface, and you play the same game. You have map from sigma Betty, let's say, to BG. That's the derived stack of flat G connection on sigma. This is zero symplectic then. And on the smooth locus, you recover the original symplectic connection I was symplectic structure I was talking in the beginning of the talk. And more interesting, if let's say X is a three manifold, still oriented and compact, then let's do this map from X Durham to BG. It's actually, that was a local system, even though these are equivalent. That's modular space of flat G connection on X. And this is minus one shifted symplectic. And here, already we can get an answer to one of the questions we were asking in the beginning. So actually, without using the derived structure, if you look at the moduli space of flat connections, actually you can prove that locally it looks like a critical locus of a function on the finite dimensional guy. So I think, I don't know a paper where it's done. I know how, I think Joyce and Song did it for holomorphic chain summons theory. But it works. I mean, it's even easier in the case of actual Chern Simons theory. So locally, it's a critical locus. But from this, using another result of Chris Brav, Victoria Bussi, and Dominic Joyce, and probably because it's for stacks also. Oren Ben Bassat. So the theorem says the following. So if Y is a minus one shifted symplectic stack, then it looks locally like a derived critical locus. Which implies, in particular, that on the smooth locus, it will be locally a critical locus. So somehow, at least locally, from the fact that this is minus one shifted symplectic, you recover a local action functional. Not a global one, but a local one.
Not really true in the Artan case.
Sorry?
In the Artan case, it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yes, you're right.
I think you can change the meaning of the word local.
Sorry?
I think you can change the meaning of the word locally. I don't
exactly.
Know,
anyway.
It wouldn't be true smooth locally.
No, it's not true smooth locally.
Who said smooth locally?
Sorry?
Who said smooth locally?
No, you don't get a smooth atlas for which by direct critical loci. That's not true. Anyway, in the end, I say a result which gives up to a tal morphism a kind of global potential. Well, even though we're close to the end. Okay, so that's one of the things that it gives. I want to also discuss Lagrangian structures. Let me be a bit more fast with this. So let's assume that we have some n-shifted symplectic guy. And we have a map L to X. And you would like to say that being Lagrangian means that if you pull back the form on L, it's equal to zero, and you get some maximality of the dimension. In this context, you cannot really do this. So you say that it's Lagrangian, and again, being Lagrangian is more structure, is that if the pullback of omega is homotopic to zero by some specific homotopy, and what it really means in the very explicit Durham algebra I was writing, it really means that F star of omega 0 is exact, but also f star of omega 1 is also exact. So it's just d deram of gamma 0 plus d int of some gamma 1, etc. Right? So let me, well, in Lagrangian plus some non-degeneracy condition that I'm not going to write. So let me just, again, give a lot of examples of these. So I think the fanciest example will give you an answer to one of the questions I was asking in the beginning, is that if you consider the point, well, it's shifted symplectic for whatever, because 0 is, it happens to be non-degenerate on the point. And you look at, well, there's only one map to the point, and you look at all possible Lagrangian structures on these morphisms. And that happens to be exactly the same as n-shifted symplectic structures on X, on L. So this is where you see that Lagrangian is really not a property. It's really an additional structure. So other examples are like if you have a map M to G star mu, which is G equivariant, you get a map on the quotient stacks. And now we've seen that G star mod G is one shifted symplectic. And it happens that the Lagrangian structures on this are equivalent to the data of a symplectic structure on M such that mu is a moment map. That's one of the things you can prove. You can do actually the same for maps with values in the group. You get what is called group-valued moment map, or another name for this is quasi-Hamiltonian G-space I was talking about before. So you just realize that all, I mean, part of the machinery that was used to construct this symplectic structure on the moduli space of flat connection can be encoded by specific Lagrangian morphisms. And there's a particularly nice feature of Lagrangians. If you have a Lagrangian correspondence, by this I just mean a Lagrangian morphism to x1 cross x2 with the opposite symplectic structure, and another one from x2 to x3. So these are Lagrangian correspondences. They compose well. I mean, L12 cross L23 over x2, it has remaining map to x1 and x3. That's, again, a Lagrangian correspondence. And okay, well, okay. Let me take 5 more minutes. So apply this to x1 being equal to x3 being the point. Then you get that intersections of Lagrangian in a symplectic guy is one less shifted symplectic. So if you have L1 and L2 Lagrangian in X and symplectic. And for instance, It gives a very nice interpretation of symplectic reduction or quasi-Hamiltonian reduction. So let me do it in the symplectic reduction case. We've seen that moment maps are examples of Lagrangian morphisms. Well, looking at the one-shifted symplectic structure I wrote for G star mod G, you can really easily convince yourself that the map from point mod G is Lagrangian. So you do the derived intersection of these two. That's the derived version of the reduced guy. And this guy inherits a 1 minus 1, so a zero-shifted symplectic structure. Okay. Right, so there were too many things to say. Okay. Let me maybe conclude with the following theorem, which says that it's an analog of the PTVV theorem in the relative setting. So if now M has a boundary, so it's still oriented, compact, then we have the mapping stack, let's say, from M Betty to some symplectic guy. And we have a restriction map to the boundary. And just using Poincaré duality, relative Poincaré duality, you can prove that this map is actually Lagrangian. And so as a consequence, you get that the derived moduli stack of flat connections on M going to the derived moduli stack of flat connection on sigma is indeed Lagrangian. And here, Lagrangian makes sense for maps, not, I mean, you don't have to assume any smoothness. Of course, I mean, if you want to recover the usual results, put some restrictions so that this map, this guy become a manifold, and such that, well, this one into this other one is a submanifold, and then you get that these are actual Lagrangians. And let me just add one remark, saying that all this behaves well with composition of coborisms. So if you glue coborism on the other side after having applied the map construction, you get composition of Lagrangian correspondence. So you get really something that looks like a topological field theory. It actually is a topological field theory, so it depends in which sense you want to say it. So if you just mod out by all homotopies, it's actually correct. And if you want to care about the higher structure, it's an almost theorem. I mean, it's an ongoing project with Rune Haugsing and Claudia Scheinbauer. Okay, I don't have so much time, but I just want to point out that you can write your three manifold as a Heard splitting, then the moduli space of flat G connection on your three manifold would just be written as a derived intersection. And if for quantization purpose, that's very good to have things in that description. Okay, I will stop here. Thank you very much.
This last theorem, does it follow more or less from the techniques you described previously, or it requires separate proof?
Yeah, so the proof of the relative version is very similar to the one which you can find in PTVV. So I wrote this proof, but the techniques are just really much pretty much the same. So the techniques in PTVV relies on an abstract version of Poincaré duality. And this one just is an abstract version of relative Poincaré duality. I mean, that's nothing more than that.
It all looks true to me, but I feel like if you want to do this as a mathematician, not a physicist, maybe somebody needs to write a few hundred page paper about foundations.
For what? For
the whole C infinity version of everything.
Oh, no, I agree that, if So I phrased it in the differentiable case because I thought that the background of people here would be more like this. But it is true that you would have to repeat all what has been written in the algebraic geometry context, in the C-infinity context. I'm not saying that it's not going to be long, but it's not going to be difficult. That's what I'm saying. While compared to doing in the complex analytic context, where there are crucial technical difficulties that I know some people know how to deal with, but I would not know how to deal with.
So what's the difference between the C-infinity rings and the complex analytic version, which makes complex analytic things faster?
So I think the crucial difference is that for C-infinity rings, you can use Rn as models. You don't need to use open. I mean, open subset of Rn or Rn, it doesn't change anything. While in the holomorphic context, just Cn is not enough. You need all these Stein open subsets. So that makes life much harder, I think. But I'm no expert in this, so.
Do you use any of the positive aspects of differential geometry, like the existence of partitions of unity?
Here never. There's one aspect which is very nice, is that, for instance, the mapping stack out of X Betty or out of X Durham, they are equivalent. So in algebraic geometry, that's not true. That's true if you analytify, and then I would get into trouble. But it's true in the differential geometry context. And for instance, then you get, you get this nice map from, let's say, G-local systems on sigma that's just flat G connection on sigma. And so the nice thing is that if you put a complex structure on your curve, there's actually a nice C-infinity stack, derived stack, which you can call X sub del bar, which actually encodes the complex geometry. I should write sigma. And here, you would get, if you map out of this to BG, you get G bundle on sigma, but holomorphic G bundle on sigma. Right? And this map happens to be a Lagrangian fibration. And, well, again, we proved it in the different, we have to write it in the algebraic geometry context with Tony and the other guys from PTVV. That whenever you have a Lagrangian vibration, on the top guy, you have a global potential. So if you have a Lagrangian vibration, up to some metallomorphism, you can write your shifted symplectic stack as a derived critical locus. For the strategy of quantization, that's very nice because it tells you, you have this Lagrangian vibration. It depends on the complex structure on the surface. So that's choice of a polarization. And once you've done this, you're in shape for doing quantization. And we get the stack as a derived critical locus. And then in that case, you know better than I that, you can perform some kind of quantization.
No. Could you say more about the topological field theory thing you were talking about just at the end before you go?
It goes from the cobordism category to the category of Lagrangian correspondence with composition of this by taking derived intersection. The point is that either you just brutally quotient by your cobordism by all diffeomorphism, and on the other side you take all Lagrangian correspondence up to equivalence, or you want to remember the whole classifying space of the diffeomorphism group, and on the left hand side you would have to care about all the higher homotopies. So Rune Haug-Zeng proved that the category of Lagrangian correspondence is an infinity one category. So at least you can state the results, and we're just trying to prove this, even with some improvement. It's actually a fully extended TFT. So it's not only just coborisms, it's coborisms between coborisms. It works. Even though I must say this field theory is a bit boring. It does not, it almost does not detect any geometry. So it only remembers, I mean, it depends on M Betty. So it only remembers about the underlying oriented homotopy type. It does not see any geometry. Well, but that's consistent. I mean, classical field theory, at least in the topological, top classical TFTs, they usually don't see so much of the geometry. It's only after quantization that you detect some actual geometric invariants.
Because you're now welcome to the Bistro Tradition Snacks, and before that, let's end this speaker.